Hey, well, there you go. Okay.
It's Dr. Jonathan Trent in the studio with us, a local scientist who's, interestingly, you started here in Santa Cruz, way back at UC Santa Cruz, one of the first students in the early 70s, and studying the ocean and microorganisms back in those days.
Yeah, I was the first wave.
That was the first wave
of Santa Cruz UCSC grads, huh?
Yeah, wow. Just after they got them out of their trailers, I was in that early group. It was quite fun.
Wow.
I probably would never have finished my academic career if it hadn't been for UCSC and its free wheeling.
Didn't do grades back then,
no
right?
No grades, not even a pass-fail. You just took a class, and if you did well, you got credit, and if you didn't do well, you didn't get credit. And then they threw you out if you didn't pass a bunch of classes in a certain time. So it wasn't totally without consequence.
Yeah. How did you decide on UC Santa Cruz?
Well, to be honest, when I finished high school, I decided I didn't want to go to the university. I wanted to just teach myself. I'm an autodidactyl kind of person, and I went and started studying in the library. But my high school girlfriend got accepted at UCSC, and she compelled me to apply.
I'm glad you're one
of those people who has been well influenced by the women you love.
Yeah.
So you went from there, and once you were in, how did you discover your passion?
Oh, my. Well, I shopped around a lot, and that was the good thing about UCSC. I came in and studied literature for a while and then switched to linguistics and mathematics and got involved with John Grinder and Richard Bandler.
Oh, NLP.
No kidding.
NLP.
Wow.
That was before it was NLP. They were working on their first books called The Structure of Magic. And they were looking for linguistic cues for behavioral patterns. And I was one of the guinea pigs that they were using in the classes that we were in. It was fun. It was interesting. But I had studied transformational grammar with John Grinder. Yeah. And then I was taking biology to be a well-rounded person. Yeah. And so I met John Pierce, who was a professor of invertebrate zoology and subtitle ecology. And I'd been a diver my whole life, and so it was really a great connection to start realizing there were names for all those
creatures
slimy
things
under
the sea.
Water.
Oh, boy.
Wow. You were a scuba diver?
I'm a scuba diver, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so the actual progression was that I was studying subtidal ecology in the kelp beds with John Pierce at Hopkins, and I had this idea. Mary Silver was my professor for pelagic ecology, studying the open ocean. And I naively said, why not use scuba to study the open ocean?
Yeah, you're out there, and I guess.
Mary gave us the keys to the Boston Whaler, and we went out in the middle of Monterey Bay and went diving, and it was quite an eye-opener. We ended up writing a paper about our observations because we were able to see things that most marine scientists couldn't sample. Our first paper was published in Science.
Is that regarding what they called snow?
Yes, marine snow is
marine
what it's
snow.
Called.
Detritus of some sort in the water?
Yeah, it's detritus. It's all kinds of remains that stay floating, a lot of mucus, slimy stuff that's in the ocean. And it's really impossible to study unless you get in the water or you have some robotic system.
Yeah.
I mean, this was back in the days when we did Apollo. We sent people to the moon.
We sent
people into the deep ocean, and that was a bit nutty, really. I mean, now we do everything with robots. They're way better than what we can do, and not depth restricted.
Yeah, well, nobody dies, right?
Would you like to switch to virtual, or were you one of the guys that really liked being out there in the field?
Oh, I was really enamored of diving in the open ocean, and I did a lot of it. I went from San Francisco to Hawaii and dove along that whole cruise track, and then Hawaii to Tahiti, and dove along that whole cruise track, and from Woods Hole to the Azores and Azores to Scotland, and dove almost every day along that cruise track. The only days we didn't dive was when the weather was really horrible and we couldn't get in the water. It was too dangerous.
Well, so you saw the world, really.
Yeah, I did, from underwater.
Underwater world. Wow.
I actually dove through most of the main currents in the ocean, not in the Arctic or in the Antarctic. Most
in the currents themselves.
Like, yeah, well, it's really quite amazing because as you cross the equator, you go through a really high productivity zone. Like, I saw the deserts and the forests and the real jungles of the ocean.
Wow.
And I took pictures.
Wow.
I took pictures along the way. Well, I had a girlfriend when I was at Scripps doing my PhD who saw some of my photographs, and she was an artist. And she said, well, you have to do an exhibit because that's how artists think. And I said, yeah. Well, no, they're just an archive of things I've observed. Yeah. No, you need to. So I gathered together all my savings as a graduate student, and I spent, I don't know, $4,000 framing all these beautiful photographs. Wow. And I put them up in an exhibit at Scripps and then at the museum in L.A. And then it was over, and I thought, wow. I was all a lot of work, and I know it's just going to sit in a closet somewhere or a garage. And so I submitted it to the Smithsonian. Oh, and I traveled with the Smithsonian's Traveling Exhibition Series for 5 years and went all over the country, in fact, all over Canada. And
wow. What was the name of the exhibit? Do you
remember? It was called UFOs, the Unfamiliar Fauna of the Open Sea.
Unfamiliar fauna.
I guess MUFON wasn't a thing yet.
No. No, it was before that. And they were all slides that I carefully had enlarged into pictures. And they're all actually now hanging at Moss Landing Marine Lab.
Oh, beautiful.
So they were all framed photographs.
The Imbari?
The San Jose State University Marine Lab in Moss Landing.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm. I've been there for like 20 years.
So. Sure. So from the ocean to other kinds of inner spaces and outer spaces. That was just your training ground.
Was that still when you were at UC? Where did you go from UC?
I left UC Santa Cruz and moved to Hopkins and worked at Hopkins Marine Station doing research for a while. And then that's in Monterey.
Yeah.
And Pacific Grove. And then I went to Scripps Institution of Oceanography.
Oh, down south, huh?
Down in La Jolla. Yeah.
Oh, that's
and I did my PhD there. I actually got involved in a really interesting project. You know, the hydrothermal vents had been discovered back then.
A lot of people thought that's where life itself emerged.
Yes, it's true. Probably not, but the temperatures are just excruciatingly
high. Well, what
was
it about the event? Is that where you first saw extremophiles?
Yeah, so what happened was the hydrothermal vents were a real mystery because they're surrounded by life in the deep ocean. And it's partly because it's like an oasis in a dark, cold environment.
Like a fire, campfire on
yes,
a cold night.
Yes, a hearth exactly. In the middle of the dark ocean.
Yes, that's a metaphor I really like to use. Yeah. And I was studying bacteria that lived in the deep ocean that are called piezophiles or barophiles. These organisms were isolated from the Marianas Trench. So, you know, that's...
I remember these articles. Weren't they, found on, old whalebone fossils or something like that?
They were actually found just in the water and in the sediments.
Oh.
And they were brought up under pressure and kept cold. And we kept them alive in the lab at 1,000 atmospheres of pressure, 1,000 bars
of
pressure.
Wow. So they might survive on a Jupiterian satellite or something, huh? They can handle the heavy pressure.
Temperature's pretty cold, but they can handle amazing pressure. So not only do they handle the pressure, but they require the pressure.
You have to build a special chamber that could withstand those pressures?
Absolutely. We had titanium cylinders, and we put the microbes inside basically syringes, plastic syringes, and we threw them in with the media inside the syringe and then capped off, and then we threw them into these titanium vessels, filled it with silicone oil, and then pressurized them. And we could decompress them once a week or every other week, and we would change their media so they could grow, and they would survive just a short period of time decompressed.
Oh, wow.
So they had to get recompressed right away or they would die.
Yeah, because we couldn't survive where they live.
No.
It really sounds like you're, to them, the equivalent of a gray alien who's putting them in a little experimental spaceship and then giving them new life experiences.
There are a lot of environments that we can't.
So how would you describe their natural habitat?
Oh, my God. Dark, cold. I mean, the only light is biologically generated.
They generate their own light?
Piezo. Yeah,
the ones we were studying didn't produce light, bioluminescence, but all around there are organisms that do.
So they had other creatures in their ecosystem.
Oh, yeah. The deep ocean is a desert, but it's not a dead desert. It's a live desert.
At least on the microbial level, especially.
Right? Oh, especially on the microbial level, right. And we're talking about harvesting magnesium nodules from the deep ocean now. And those are microbially generated over hundreds, if not thousands of years, and very slow, cold, dark environment. It's a pretty amazing place to think when you consider that it's covering 71% of the Earth's surface. Yeah. It's dark and cold and never changing. Really, the only influx is coming from stuff sinking from the surface water into this dark environment. And many of the larger organisms vertically migrate up into the surface waters and then back down.
Well, is it more stable than the land in terms of climate change?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's a very good question as to whether the oceans have always been cold, but they've certainly been cold for a very long time.
So they'd have more of an uninterrupted chain of evolution than land?
Yeah, and you know, it used to be thought in 19th century biology, evolutionary biology, people like Huxley suggested that the deep ocean was inhabited by the primordial ooze.
Because it'd be a long term, they have more years in evolving than we would.
Yes, exactly right. Yeah. And there was actually, when they went on those voyages of discovery in the early 20th century and late 19th century, they would bring samples back to the laboratory, and they found this material in the samples that they brought back that was ubiquitous. Mm. And it was somewhat organized and somewhat, it wasn't really biological, but it wasn't abiological. And it became known as Bathybius. And it was ubiquitous. And many of the scientists like Huxley and Haeckel, they were speculating about this stuff. They called it the Urschleim, you know, the ancient slime that was left over from the origins of life. And, you know, the amazing thing about this is there was a chemist that went to sea, and he collected this material to look at fresh samples, because all of the scientists at that point had looked at preserved samples that were preserved with alcohol. And what this guy discovered was that this was an artifact, that this Urschleim, which they called Bathybius Haeckeli, was only formed when they added alcohol to seawater.
And it, I couldn't find it. Complete
nonsense. There was nothing like that. And this guy discovered it. And not people who make these types of discoveries don't get very famous, because the scientific community, with their most famous people being embarrassed immediately to retract. So they're, whoops. But anyway, it's funny that you mentioned that about the Urschleim and the primitive ooze in the deep ocean.
Yes. Yeah. And it had us all this time to evolve for how many years? For a billion years?
Yeah. Well, it's not clear how long the oceans have been cold. There's some evidence that the oceans during the history of the Earth have been actually quite warm. Mm-hmm. And they've gone through excursions of cooling and warmth.
And your understanding of life is that when it's warmer, there's more life, typically, right?
Depends. The temperature range, the Goldilocks range, the temperature has to be quite right.
Well, biology loves it.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah. And it's a relation of temperature and pressure, probably, right?
Well, in the ocean, pressure is important. On land, it's not as important, although there are organisms living in the deep Earth. Mm. But the temperature limit has been something that we've been wondering about for a long time, and something that I've spent quite a lot of time studying.
Do you study organisms in the atmosphere as well?
I didn't, but there were people at NASA when I was at NASA that studied atmospheric organisms in higher altitudes.
Mm-hmm. The other extreme.
Yeah, it's not clear that they're actually metabolically active, but they're certainly sampleable. They're up in the air. But whether they're living up there or just surviving up there is a different story. Mm-hmm. You have to understand the requirements for metabolism, water, and an energy source.
Yeah, they'd have a lot of sun up there.
Well, and UV, and they would have to protect themselves from the ultraviolet.
Yeah.
Because that damages their biomolecules.
Oh, wow.
But anyway, I mean, I spent a lot of time studying all this stuff. Yeah, I ended up studying extremophiles from hydrothermal vents.
Do they have a genetic manipulation that succeeded in them being able to survive at such high temperatures underwater?
You mean the organisms living in the highest temperatures?
Extremophiles in the high temperatures. Yeah, I heard they're like, some of them had flagelli that would cool the water around them by flipping really fast. That would cause the water to be cooler in their immediate membrane vicinity. I don't know. How did they survive at these temperatures?
Well, you have to understand that bacteria are so small. Yeah. So they're a fraction of the diameter of a human hair.
Huh.
And so they live in a world that's completely alien to us. So when you say that they're flipping their flagella and they're moving the water, that's not true. It's been compared. If you were a microbe, if you were the size of a bacterium and you had a flagellum, moving your flagella would be like being in a swimming pool of molasses at room temperature.
Ah, so really hard.
So the so-called Reynolds number is incredibly low. And so their whole environment, and you're moving your hands through this pool of molasses at the speed of the minute hand on a clock. They move incredibly fast. If you look at it in body lengths per hour and you compared it to a bicyclist, they're moving at a speed which would be comparable to riding a bike at, I think it was 600 miles per hour.
Wow.
And they stop within one body length. So they're moving incredibly fast if you look at it at
from
scale.
That point of view, yeah. What kind of communities do they have?
So they're totally different. It's incredible diversity of organisms down there. Right. Yeah. And they live within communities, it's true. What we end up studying in the lab are the freaks that we can isolate.
You take them out of their community.
Yeah, you take them out of their community, and then some weird organism that might be a keystone species in the sense that you provide it with some kind of growth medium, and that organism survives. And all the others are not capable of dealing with the complexity of the change that you just made.
Oh. So.
But, I mean, these organisms are amazing, there's no doubt. And I studied their biochemistry for a long time. Their DNA didn't explain how they could survive. It was long hypothesized that the DNA would be GC-rich, which means two or rather of the nucleotides that are holding the DNA together that have an extra bond in them would make the DNA more stable. And that proved not to be true, that the DNA was not stabilized that way. In fact, I studied an organism near boiling sulfuric acid, and it had a very low GC content.
And that was its natural habitat?
Its natural habitat. It was first observed in the hot springs in Yellowstone by a guy named Tom Brock in the 1960s or 70s. And it's interesting because they went to look for them, and Tom Brock, who's the professor, said, well, there's nothing alive in that pool. Yeah. Then his grad students found these organisms living there, which they called Sophilobus.
Oh, Sophilobus.
Wow. Sophilobus acidulcodarius was the name.
And this is the ones that they tell you not to put your foot in the water there because of these bacteria in the Yellowstone water?
No, it's only because the water is so hot and so acidic that your skin would slough off.
Oh, it's not because of the bacteria.
No. They don't live at temperatures below 150 degrees. So they would never be able to be pathogenic because they can't cope with our body temperature.
It's totally alien territory for them.
We're too cold.
Completely too cold. To
It is interesting because they must have had a whole interesting history about how they survived the ice ages and stuff.
Well, you know, a lot of microbes survive, a lot of high temperature microbes and a lot of medium temperature microbes and even low temperature microbes survive really well when they get cooled down, provided they get cooled down fast enough. Oh. Right? So cryopreservation.
Yeah, that's
well, you find mammoth frozen in the glacier somewhere.
Right, so, with the lunch in the tummy.
And there's tissues that are available to use, right? That doesn't break down.
So cryopreservation works well for microbes.
It works well for microbes. Not so well for humans because of the complexity of it. We haven't figured out how to thaw us out. We can freeze us pretty well, but thawing us out is a little bit of a
problem. The big story this week was that they've successfully done this with brain tissue.
Oh, okay.
The brain tissue seems to be preserved and can be thawed out after 3 months.
That makes sense. It's a lot of fatty tissue there. It's a lot of fat in it. So fat has a way of organizing when it gets cooled. Mm-hmm. And the key has always been freezing at the right rate. If you freeze too slowly and there's water present, then the crystals grow and they damage the cell membranes.
Sure.
Disrupt
the sharp edges.
If you freeze them incredibly fast, like plunge freeze them in a way that they really get exposed.
The flash freeze concept.
Flash freeze, but do it in a way that it doesn't go from the outside in, but goes through the whole thing.
All at once.
Then all at once. And then the water molecules stay as tiny little structures.
Because I understand water, when it gets colder, expands, unlike
water
a lot of substances.
Water expands, and it grows into crystals when it freezes.
That's what's deadly to the membrane.
That's right. But if you can freeze it fast enough that the water doesn't have time to crystallize, then the organisms can survive this kind of freezing.
Well, so you could do whole body freezes then.
Yeah, in principle.
What kind of technology freezes that way, though? Temperature from the inside out?
Well, from when you're a micron in diameter, when you're a fraction of the size of a hair, you can do this by plunge freezing organisms. And actually, usually you use what's called a cryoprotectant. That is, you soak them in something that helps to maintain them. And there are organisms that produce these funny
being dropped into a vat of liquid nitrogen or something like that.
Yeah, liquid nitrogen is not so good because it boils off. But there are organisms that have these cryoprotectants in them that are yeast and certain cells that produce these polysaccharides, these sugars. They replace the water. And there's things like tardigrades that are incredible survivors under these harsh conditions.
Yeah.
It's fun to talk about this stuff because it's my ancient history.
Yeah, it's a little background for you.
We love extremophiles, and we love this kind of contemplation of the universe of microbes and the building blocks of the bigger kingdoms.
Well, it is 228.
I like talking about that.
And the second half, we were going to go into your current project.
Yeah, okay. We were just getting to know you.
Okay.
And letting people hear what wonderful things you've been paying attention to.
Yeah, because we do know that, in a sense, your story is a bit like a Joseph Campbell story arc, where you started here, you went out into the world, learned many things, and you brought them back home. You brought them back to your here, and you're sharing them with us, your local community today.
Yeah, the journey of the hero, of course.
Yeah. What do you brought back to us? And you're going to have a project that actually transforms a bit of our ecosystem and our energy structure and our data structure.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I think about my career. Uh-huh. When I was doing marine science, I got involved in open water diving, and that provided an insight into marine science at the time that a marine scientist, a biologist, or even a marine chemist or geologist studied the ocean with a net they dragged through the water or with a bottle they hung off a ship, and the ship's going up and down. And everything that's fragile or small and fragile in the ocean really was invisible to them because it was destroyed under the sampling conditions. And I jumped in the water and I said, "Woo, look at that. And then I, of course, able to sample with a syringe one tiny volume of water, and then right next to it, less than an inch away, another volume of water, and I could compare them in the laboratory in ways that the other people on board couldn't. And that provided some insights. And then I was studying the effects of pressure and temperature on microbes. And some people came with samples from the so-called hydrothermal vents that we talked about.
Yeah, yeah.
And they tried to get bacteria to grow under these super high temperature and high pressure conditions. And they did experiments in our lab with a high temperature, high pressure apparatus. And they got data and they published it in Nature. And I was in the lab and I was watching everything they were doing. And they got it published in Nature. But I watched what they did, and I knew a lot about pressure at the time. And I said, wait. They didn't do all the right experiments. And I did the control experiments that they, quote-unquote, didn't have time to do. And so I discovered their results were completely wrong.
Wow.
And so their so-called black smoker bacteria, which is what the hydrothermal vents are called because of the metal sulfides that form black smoke-like stuff.
Yeah.
And they was wrong. I published a paper saying that all of their data can be explained in another way. And I was invited to a lab in Germany where they were studying real thermophiles that grew at 220 degrees Fahrenheit. And that was exciting. I brought to them the possibility of sampling the ocean. And we went around to a lot of hot springs and sampled places.
Wow, what a fun job.
Sicily. It was fun. Yeah, it was
so
fun.
The ocean was the lab.
Yeah. Wow. Hey, we do have to take a break for a moment. Then we'll come back and we're going to talk about your latest project.
Oh, great. I'm looking forward to that.
All right.
See you in a minute.
We're with Jonathan Trent here on Santa Cruz Voice, Future Now. We'll be right back.
What's your family eating for dinner? Chef Ben here at the Back Nine Grill and Bar, where you can pick up family dinner that feeds 4 to 6 hungry people. Family meals include a full rack of ribs, a whole smoked chicken, pound of pulled pork, and plenty of barbecue sauce. Served with a full quart of baked beans, coleslaw, macaroni and cheese, dinner rolls, pickles, a side of onions, and for dessert, brownies with a pint of Mary Ann's vanilla ice cream. Call and order your family's dinner about 15 minutes before you want to eat. See you at the Nine.
Attention content producers. You can have access to a complete digital media production facility at Satellite Co-working and Digital Media Studio on Soquel Avenue. Easily rent video and audio equipment, a studio with green screen, editing suite, and audio booth, all at Can't Say No Rapes. Schedule a tour to see for yourself at satellitecoworking.com. Mention Santa Cruz Voice for 20% off your first reservation.
Hey, Warren, you know it's been a while since I've been up to your showroom and garden center in Scotts Valley. Maybe the folks out there might want to know where you are.
Absolutely. To find Knox Roofing and the Knox Garden Box Company, just head up into beautiful Scotts Valley. We're at 46 El Pueblo Road, next door to Scarborough Lumber and the beautiful nursery. And when it comes to wood items, we have It's All About Wood gift shop. And, of course, the Knox Garden Box. Lots to look at. We'd love to see you at Knox Roofing and the Knox Garden Box store. Okay, thanks, folks.
Cannabis is one of nature's most beneficial plants. Hello, I'm Jenna. Treehouse Dispensary, we use information about cannabis to build community. Listen to Carly.
Thanks, Jenna. For those who wake up in the middle of the night, Treehouse suggests a THC-CBN chocolate edible blend like Sleepy Time from Sensi Chew. Sleep the night away.
For answers to your cannabis questions, ask your friends at Treehouse Dispensary, 3651 SoCal Drive in SoCal, or ourtreehouse.io.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back.
We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Trent. Well, he's been talking about extremophiles and his background here from UC Santa Cruz moving forward and studying the most extreme forms of life on the planet.
But that was just for the fun of it. We really wanted to talk about today is based on that depth of awareness and insight, but it's a whole new kind of invention that is going to benefit people here in Santa Cruz and a lot of other folks in the future.
I was studying these extremophiles, and I'm studying a particular protein that they make called a heat shock protein. And that protein was incredibly interesting because when I characterized the protein, it turned out to be related to a human protein. Oh. And this gave me a cover on Nature and kind of fame and blah, blah, blah. And I went on to study it a lot more. It became a very controversial topic. And it forced me, because of the science, the scientific community being peer review, I kind of became a pariah in the scientific community because what I observed with this extremophile didn't fit with the central dogma or the central paradigm of the scientific community at the time.
Well, original thinking is almost punished in these circles, right?
It really is. I think Schopenhauer said it best, is that truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third, it is taken as self-evident. And so until my theory becomes self-evident, I had to find another thing to do. And so because I couldn't get grants that were peer-reviewed because people were out to get me for my weirdness and my theories based on the extremophile. And one of the things I started doing, I called the Green Team at NASA, which was global research into energy and the environment at NASA. And it was basically saying, well, look, NASA's come up with a lot of great technology. What can we really apply to the global problems that are so pressing and so imminent in terms of the disasters that we keep hearing about that are really global in scale?
Well, isn't NASA naturally thinking of outer space rather than Earth space?
Always, but the original mandate, the original charter for NASA was to study space for the benefit of the Earth. And so I went back to the charter from 1950 and said, hey, everyone, what we're going to do with the Green Team is look at how we can utilize space technology to do things really good for the Earth.
Like satellite information.
Satellite information is a great example. The whole digitization, and ironically, that's what I'm working on now. The detour I made was I tried to work on biofuels for a while, harking back to my marine days, and started a project to look at whether we could grow algae, microalgae, marine microalgae, which are responsible for 80 to 90% of all the oil that we currently harvest from the deep earth.
Really? So oil comes from algae?
Comes from algae. Most of it. 90% of it. 80 to 90%.
So that's the biomass, huh, that creates the oil?
They're not only the biomass, they actually produce the oil. So algae, they store starches the way a normal plant would do, but when they're going for a long-term storage, they store oils. Higher energy density, a little more difficult metabolically to make, but a lot bigger bang for the buck.
Wow.
So these algae, which were incredibly abundant, got buried during the course of time. And they're the ones that ooze their oil out into the sediments that we harvest now for the most part.
Right?
Wow. So I thought, well, maybe we could grow microalgae in a way that wouldn't compete with farming, wouldn't compete with agriculture to make biofuels. And the idea I came up with, which I called the Omega Project, was offshore membrane enclosures for growing algae. So here's the plan.
Algae farms?
We do algae farms offshore, freshwater algae growing on our freshwater wastewater from our community that we currently dump into the ocean and don't utilize the nutrients, causing algae blooms locally. And we capture that wastewater, it's freshwater, and we grow freshwater oil-producing algae in floating bioreactors. If they escape into the ocean, they die. because they can't cope with a marine environment.
They don't like salt.
Yeah.
They're freshwater creatures.
I did a TED Talk about this. Uh-huh. So a lot of people watched my TED Talk about it. And I raised $10.8 million to do a feasibility study.
Was that the woman at NASA? The scientist that helped approve your budget, I think it was mentioned in your biography.
Yeah, Lori Garver.
Yeah.
That was a wonderful story. She came to visit NASA Ames when she was first appointed by Barack Obama. Yeah. And I was presenting to her this idea. And she said, "This is a wonderful idea. What do you need to do it?" And I said, "Well, I need $10 million. And she said, "How do you know that?" And I said, "Well, I just wrote a DOE grant proposal that was turned down." And she said, "I'll see what I can do." And a few weeks later, I had $10 million from NASA headquarters.
Wow.
And so have you been implementing it?
Yeah. So I did that project, and I kind of proved that it's really going to be difficult to compete with the oil industry, given its maturity and how relatively easy it is to harvest these bodies of oil that are under the earth.
Yeah.
But it really kept me working more and more on this project towards sustainability. Mm-hmm. What can we do with NASA technology?
Well, how long does it take to make oil from algae? If you could speed up the process, it doesn't take millions of years.
No. We can actually use the algae even just as a biomass. And through a process of pyrolysis, we can make oil.
Pretty fast.
A matter of hours.
And scale that could a village have their own? Could Santa Cruz have our own gas stations from algae off the ocean?
Scaling and price are the two
hard parts. We could. But there might be better forms.
If we use all of the wastewater in San Francisco and we put it in a big floating bioreactor system in the San Francisco Bay, we would need about 1,200 acres of floating algae pods or tubes to be able to produce enough oil to make fuel for about half of the trucks and cars that the city of San Francisco runs around San Francisco.
All right. So in a hybrid universe, it might be an interesting source of some.
It's not trivial. It's not trivial.
No, right. But it had to be a major need for something like that. And it's much cheaper just to use regular oil
at this point. Although nobody actually calculates the real cost. The real cost in terms of the environmental impact.
In terms of the lack of sustainability and what's going to happen 1,000 years from now when we've mined everything was on the planet to
maybe
begin
100
with.
Years from
but
now.
We have a lot of options now. I mean, I suppose, you know, you're down at Scripps, you probably know about Craig Venter and his whole approach and being able to re-engineer some of these microorganisms to eat our waste and create useful gases from the output. Like I think you're talking about biodigesters would be a key technology.
Yeah. So, you know, one of these, I should tell the people out there that the organisms that live in these extreme environments, some of them are bacteria. They look like bacteria. If you know what a bacterium looks like, they're tiny, tiny, tiny spheres of life. They look like that, but on a molecular level, they're really different, and they've been characterized as a separate group of organisms called archaea. And among the archaea, there's an organism called a methanogen. And a methanogen is probably some of the most primitive life forms because they don't require oxygen to grow. In fact, they're poisoned by oxygen. They live in what's called an anaerobic condition. And the interesting thing about them is if you give them organic material without any air present, without any oxygen present, they produce a gas called methane.
Yes, I've heard of methane.
And methane is natural gas. It's the same as, they're just two different words for exactly the same thing. Biogas has got methane in it. It also has some other gases in it that are
Isn't it considered detrimental to the atmosphere, methane?
Yeah, methane is terribly detrimental. It's about 83 times worse than CO2 in terms of heating
that's
up
we're
the atmosphere
about these days.
On the short term. And on a longer term, it's about 25 times worse. It has a different residence time
in the
atmosphere.
The cow burps and farts and the cow issues come from
that too. About 30% of the methane release.
So you can make even more.
The thawing of the tundra is another source of methane.
Yes. Tundra. All the bogs, the tundra, every place where you can get a situation where you can seal the atmosphere away, use up all the oxygen as the gas permeates through the soil, and then as you get deeper, you get to this black soil where the blackness is caused by the precipitation of metal sulfides and such things. And that's all done by methanogenesis. And methane seeps out of those places, and you can actually light it on fire. So the deep earth, where oil is producing, is often producing methane at the same time. So you can get liquid oil, or you can get methane. Oh. And when they pop into those wells, and they drill the wells into the deep earth, you often see them flaring off, lighting the methane so it doesn't release into the atmosphere because it's such a bad greenhouse gas.
Right.
And so they turn it into CO2 by burning it.
Oh. See.
But we have a better idea.
How methane
could be. The reason we're here to talk about it today is this better idea.
Right. So let me cut to the chase because I don't know how much
time. Yeah, we only
have
15 minutes.
15 minutes.
Yeah, about that.
Let me quickly tell you what's going on here. So let's talk about methane.
Okay. Now, it's already, we're thinking bad. Methane's too much of it, and it's being released everywhere. That's a problem. But you're saying that methane is actually useful.
But he just pointed out the methane's coming out of all these natural places, but anyway, it's also coming out of places like landfills.
Where
we're burying all our organic waste. And there, too, it loses its contact to the air, and it becomes methane, and it seeps out into the atmosphere. So Governor Brown, back in 2015, who was quite conscious about environmental issues, said, hey, wait a minute, we should stop putting all this organic waste into our landfills and making methane for the atmosphere. And that was like 2015, and by 2022, a law called Senate Bill 1383 got passed. And that law went into effect in 2024. And this means that in all cities in California, we will no longer put organic waste into our landfills. So what are we going to do?
All right. So we've forbidden it. Have we come up with an alternative strategy? What are we doing
with
it?
There's two things you can do with it.
Okay.
One thing is you can put it into a pile of dirt and other organics and keep it aerated by turning it.
Compost it.
And it composts.
Uh-huh.
Right. Uh-huh. So as long as the air is present, you compost it. Or you can put it into a big tank and let it go completely anaerobic, no oxygen, use up all the oxygen, and make methane. But don't let the methane out into the atmosphere. You use the methane for something positive. So that could be methane is natural gas, is what we burn in our stoves, so we can burn it in a stove.
And like an internal combustion engine could run on methane.
Exactly. We have buses running on methane, natural gas buses, right? Uh-huh. And they call them renewable natural gas buses if they get the methane from biology.
But we also have another source for power.
So the other source of power is you can turn a generator from that internal combustion engine, and still another source is called a fuel cell.
The fuel cell is something NASA is a pioneer in, understanding, back to the Apollo program.
Right. Fuel cells were invented in the 19th century. They're really old. But the idea that they're really developing now to be efficient.
So for the uninitiated, how would you quickly describe a fuel cell?
So a fuel cell does the chemistry of taking the methane at super high temperature and breaking it into hydrogen and carbon. And the carbon, in the presence of oxygen, turns into CO2, and the hydrogen makes water, and the system runs a charge of electricity at the same time that it's making this chemistry happen.
So it's generating electricity?
Generating electricity with no combustion and no moving parts.
Wow.
So how come we're not using them more these days?
Yeah, because for a while they weren't very cost-effective.
Mm-hmm.
But the technology has really, really improved a lot, and they can be used now very effectively. And they have some difficulties. You can't throttle them up and throttle them back very easily, right? So we use energy very episodically, and you can't do that very well with a fuel cell. Mm-hmm. So the fuel cell energy should go be stored in a battery.
So a battery-fuel cell combo would be make
perfect.
A lot of sense, right?
Yeah, or use a place which requires a lot of energy and make electricity
constant power.
That needs a constant power.
Like our data centers?
Like a data center.
Or
ding, ding, ding.
A data center. Wait, I just want to add to the list also a future, like when we go for all the electric cars and, charging centers so that batteries can just be sitting in charging centers and people can drive in and swap out the batteries
fuel
and drive
cell chargers.
Off.
Absolutely.
Fuel cell charging systems.
Yeah. Right. All right, but let's talk about your data centers.
So data centers, first of all, for the uninitiated, data centers is really what's going on with the cloud right now and artificial intelligence.
Yeah, when people talk about the fact that Bitcoin is using cities worth of electricity, we're talking about data centers running computers, basically.
So our thirst for power is increasing practically exponentially.
Yeah, it's amazing. And by the way, it doesn't stop where you just mentioned all those things are in the news, but it's your cell phone. goes through a data center. And all those pictures you put on the cloud are stored in a data center.
Right.
And so, when you go to the bank and you use a credit card, you're using a data center. And when you look at Netflix, you're looking at data center.
And this podcast is using a
data center.
Yes, and it's, and it's replacing normal radio on TV.
We want more.
And there are data centers doing virtually every part of our digital society.
So if you go into a data center, it is kind of an alien environment for humans, right?
Oh, my God. Yes,
it's just walls and walls of CPUs or
they're racks. They're called racks, and each of them has a server or 20 servers piled up in a rack that's 24
servers.
Inches by 47 inches by 67 inches tall.
Wow.
And they're filled with hundreds, or not thousands, of these racks, and they use a lot of electricity.
I bet.
They produce a lot of heat.
Yeah, you have to vent the heat out.
Well, either vent it or capture it.
Oh, yes, instead of throwing it away. Let's use it for something.
Yeah.
Use it for something.
Uh-huh.
Great.
So what can we use it for? And that was the question. Well, it turns out...
Well, heat is a big part of many biological processes.
Including that anaerobic digester that we just talked about for turning organic material into electricity. That happens at about 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
Ooh,
and the temperature coming out of the data center, usually cooled by water, is water at about 100 to 120 degrees.
Oh.
So it's not hot enough to really heat your house because you can't put it through a pipe very easily. Yeah. But if you had your data center built near your digester, then the data center heat can go to heat that digester.
Okay, so I'm imagining a building full of servers that's got a giant compost ring around it that's getting fed the heat from the building in the middle.
Well, it's vented, have to be bad
vented, yeah.
It's, huh?
It's a good idea. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a donut ring. It could just be a little tank alongside.
Somewhere nearby.
And the data center doesn't have to be a huge football size, 200, 300 megawatt scale. It could be 1 megawatt, and it can be in a shipping container.
Yeah. All right.
So they build modular data
centers. Is that a neighborhood, a megawatt? How many people can use a megawatt? About 25 households, something like that? 40?
Maybe less. Yeah, that could be a pretty big...
Yeah, it could be. And I'm just thinking of following the curve here. You go into a digester, all this heat. Now, what's in the digester that's being heated? Is it the microbes that are...
We're putting our food waste.
Yeah, so you're putting in the, all the...
Okay, so waste management picks up the green bucket, and those trucks dump all that green bucket waste into a pile somewhere.
Or into a
shipping container?
No, they're putting it into... A big tank. It'll be a concrete tank.
Your organic waste of various sorts. So grass
clippings. Are we calling it a digester?
Fats. It can be stuff from restaurants. It can be leftover food from markets.
Could it be cellulose, like cut grass from the...
Can be to some degree, not just that. Cows eat grass and they make loads of methane.
Then you have different microbes for different.
You could use like the apple pulp from Martinelli's.
Biological, basically.
Anything biological could be broken down.
Okay. And do you have specific combinations of microbes to deal with different.
Then they come up pretty spontaneously. Well, if you add a little cow dung or cow manure.
There you go.
And it's 100 degrees, so it's not really an extreme environment. In my world.
Yeah.
So you don't need extremophiles to make this.
There are extremophiles, by the way, and you can make the digester function all the way up to about 160 degrees Fahrenheit. So there are so-called thermophilic, temperature-loving, anaerobic, low-oxygen methanogens that generate methane. But we don't need to go there. We can do it at a lower temperature.
Okay. All right. So then we digest this bio waste, and then we harvest the methane, and then what happens?
Methane and you said potable water comes out?
Well, wait. We have to cool the data center.
Oh. Yeah.
So we're harvesting the heat from the data center by cooling it with water. And the water goes into the data center in what's called a heat exchanger, and the heat from the data center is dumped into the water, and the water comes out of the data center pretty hot.
And that's what goes into the biodigester.
And that's what goes into our digester in the temperature control loop that heats up the digester.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And the digester exports...
The methane.
Methane.
And we use it in a fuel cell
to make
electricity for...
Yeah,
the data center.
Yeah, back to the data center.
It's a circle.
But it still needs more input from the outside as well.
Wow, totally sustainable. Yeah.
We can make a megawatt of energy for our data center with 100 tons of organic material a day, and that's about what we produce in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, so it can power itself?
Yep.
All right.
Have access to share with the
it would.
Community?
It would have plenty of access, depending on where we uh-huh. built it. Yep. It depends on how much stuff we put into it. And by the way, what we're doing right now in the city of Santa Cruz is we're exporting our organic waste. We're grinding it up and we're putting it in tanker trucks and we're driving it up to Oakland to go into a digester.
They have one already
there.
Oh,
so they're a little ahead of us, huh? Yeah, all we need to do is attach a
most wastewater treatment plants have got digesters, and they put human solid waste, so-called biosolids, into these digesters and turn it into methane. And they use the methane in generators to generate all the power they need for their water treatment
plants. So using the generators with the methane, and you're suggesting that the fuel cells are more efficient use of the energy than generators.
And the other good thing about what I just told you, unlike using the human waste, is that when we take the food waste into the equation, what comes out of the digester when you muck it out is perfect fertilizer. If you use human waste, then you run into the difficulty that human waste can't go on food crops officially.
Right, because it needs to be sanitized.
It can go on food crops if it's been heated and pasteurized.
But we have plenty of other waste.
But
to
it
work
has to go
meantime.
A higher temperature.
It has to go to cotton or some other non-food
crop.
Yeah,
right, it's more of an issue.
But here we have a food waste which can be organic fertilizer and be used extensively. So we get methane and we get compost out of our food waste. At the same time, we get electricity, and we have a data center. That's
and we have salty water going into the ocean that isn't polluting the ocean.
Oh, well, that's another part of the story.
Yeah. Like, where would you locate this?
So I'm thinking UC Santa Cruz, possibly, or Watsonville Wastewater Treatment Plant, just near the Pajaro River. Yeah, and it's an ideal location in many ways because they already are exporting water to the farmlands near there. And the story about the salt water is interesting, but we probably don't have time to go into it. But it's an interesting side story about
part of
the seawater intrusion.
Yeah, we have that's a big issue here.
Oh, the seawater intrusion, Our underground water is getting polluted by ocean water, right?
Yeah, forming brackish water, a mixture of freshwater and seawater. And so what we initially proposed is that we would use this brackish water to cool the data center. And the reason for that is the warm water coming out of the data center saves a lot of energy in purification. So if you purify brackish water that's hot, it uses half the energy of purifying that same water when it's cold.
Oh, so we can distill water and have potable water out of that? And
You do reverse osmosis. You don't distill it.
Oh, okay. Filter it.
You could distill it, a vacuum distillation.
Oh, cool. Wow. Well, how many legs do you have for this project? It sounds so wonderful.
Well, I've talked to the chancellor's office and to the engineering department at UC Santa Cruz, and we're in the process of thinking about whether we could do something at UCSC.
Very early stages.
As a demonstration project. Uh-huh. And in the city of Watsonville, I've been talking to the people in the public utilities office, and they need to upgrade their wastewater plant. And this may be a good way to upgrade it because we can get some money for innovative, new, and really biological.
Fantastic.
We need about $10
million. All right, Jonathan Trent, everybody. Yeah. Where can people find out more or keep track of you, Jonathan? This is wonderful.
Well, we haven't put a website up yet because we don't want to fill the data centers with more dark data. But we're in the process of making a website so that once this project gets traction and we see a clear way forward, then we'll have a website for everybody to go see. And you guys can post it on your web.
And the project name?
The project's called Upcycle Systems.
Upcycle Systems. So we do a Google search on Upcycle Systems and we'll find something?
Well, now you won't. Now you'll find a company called Upcycle Technology. But Upcycle Systems shows up in my interview that I did with NASA. So if you Google my name and NASA
Jonathan
interview.
Trent. A NASA interview. Jonathan Trent. Thank you, Jonathan. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, John.
Alan. Thank you, son.
Have a great future now, everybody. All right. We got to get out of here for the next show. Love you guys. This is fantastic.